Chapter 23 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 23. On the day Oscar Wilde got out of prison, he left the country. Before he left, he went to the Brompton Oratory and asked to see one of the fathers. He had then, as he thought, quite made up his mind to become a Catholic, and his idea was to get received at once if he could. In this hope he would, almost certainly, have been disappointed, for although he did really know rather more than the average Protestant does about Catholicism, yet many of his views were, as appears glaringly in the published part of De Profundis, not only entirely unorthodox, but grossly repugnant to Catholicism, or indeed, one would suppose, to any form of Christianity. He asked for a certain father with whom he was personally acquainted. I do not know whom it was he asked for, but I imagine that it was probably the late Father Sebastian Bowden, a saintly old man who had formerly been in the Coldstream Guards. In any case, the father he asked for happened to be away, and though he could of course have seen any of the others, and was invited to do so, he declined. Whichever of the fathers of the oratory had seen him would, I think, certainly have told him that he could not possibly be received without at least some delay for instruction. This would probably have annoyed Oscar, for although in De Profundis he frequently refers to the supposed humility which he had acquired in prison, the book itself affords the strongest evidence that he had not even begun to understand the meaning of the word in its true Catholic or Christian sense. The idea that he required instruction in a subject in which he set up as an expert would probably have offended him very much. Indeed, I more than suspect that it was the realisation of the fact that he would certainly have to submit to instruction that caused him, when he got over to France, to drop the whole idea. He was seeing a good deal of Ross at that time, and Ross, himself a Catholic and a convert, though he afterwards, I am told, apostatised, would have been in a position to give him all the information he required as to the process of getting received into the church. That Oscar did really die a Catholic, being received into the church by a Franciscan on his deathbed, and while he was unable to speak, but still able to make signs, I now believe, though for a long time I doubted the genuineness and validity of his reception. My reasons for doubting them were that Ross, with whom at the time of Oscar's death I was supposed to be, and imagined myself to be, on the best of terms, told me most distinctly and positively that Oscar was quite unconscious at the time of his reception, and that he, Ross, had only got the Franciscan friar to consent to receive him by swearing that Oscar had asked him before he became unconscious to go at once and fetch a priest, as he was determined to die a Catholic. Ross told me that, as a matter of fact, Oscar said no such thing, and that the only justification he had for the step he took was that Oscar, years before, had told him that he intended to die a Catholic, and that if he were in danger of death, Ross, if he were present or available, was to send for a priest. Ross, according to his habit, told various stories about the event, varying them according to his own fancy and the effect he wanted to produce on his audience. At the time when he told me what I have just reproduced, I was not a Catholic, and though not hostile, yet not particularly sympathetic to Catholicism. What Ross actually said to me in effect was, "I hope you don't mind. You know how I feel about these things. Oscar several times in his life did express a desire to be a Catholic, and said that it was the only church to die in. So when he was dying, I took it on myself to fetch a priest and to tell him that Oscar had expressed an earnest desire to be received. I also thought it would make things easier in a Catholic country, and that it would facilitate arrangements for his funeral and burial. I replied that I was very glad that he acted as he did." Years afterwards, the Right Reverend Sir David Hunter Blair, Abbot of Fort Augustus, as whose guest I twice spent a week in the Benedictine Abbey of Fort Augustus, wrote me a long letter on the subject, which, unfortunately, I have not been able to find. But I remember quite well what the letter contained, and that the abbot told me that he had heard from the Franciscan friar who received Oscar, who assured him that Oscar was sufficiently conscious to hear and understand all that the friar said to him, and that, although he could not speak, he gave unmistakable signs of assent. "I satisfied myself," wrote the friar, "that he understood and assented." Thus, at the very last moment of his conscious life, betwixt the stirrup and the ground, mercy he sought and mercy found. I must say, in justice to myself, that when in 1914 I collaborated with Crossland in the book Oscar Wilde and Myself, I was in my own mind quite convinced that Oscar had not died a Catholic. What Ross had told me seemed decisive, and I could imagine no motive for his misleading me. The difference it makes in the way I am able to think of Oscar is, of course, tremendous, chiefly because the fact of his wishing to die a Catholic implies a certain state of mind which connotes a number of other things. For example, a man becoming a Catholic must, ipso facto, if his conversion be genuine, forgive all those who have injured him and ask pardon of all whom he has injured. He also implicitly renounces all heretical opinions and expresses contrition for all his sins, both of the flesh and of the spirit. By the way, St. Thomas Aquinas, who, Catholically speaking, is the ultimate word and touchstone of wisdom, lays it down that sins of the spirit are much worse than sins of the flesh, and that is the chief reason why I think that the English attitude towards certain vices is indefensible, except, of course, in the case of persons who have never, by thought, word, or deed, been implicated in them themselves. For hypocrisy is a spiritual sin. I must explain that I do not mean that a man who has committed sins of the flesh at one time of his life has not a perfect right to feel and express horror at such sins once he has got to realise how horrible they are. But I mean that such a man has no right whatever to persecute or hound down another for doing what he has done himself or condoned in others. It all comes down to the truly heavenly saying of Jesus, "Let him that is without sin among you first cast a stone." Nor do I think that a man can get out of this comfortably, as the average Englishman thinks he can, by saying that whatever he may have done in other, what he calls legitimate, ways, he has never, at any rate since he left school, gone in for Oscar Wilde's particular vice. I very much doubt if such a complacent view of the relative importance of his own and someone else's form of sin will cut much ice at the day of judgment. All sins of the flesh are mortal sins, and are, on the one hand, from that point of view, equally deadly, and, on the other hand, equally easy to obtain absolution for, on the proper conditions. Hence the attitude of the criminal law in France is more logical and more Christian than it is in England. Precisely, of course, because France is still a Catholic country. In France, Oscar Wilde could not have been sent to prison for what he had done, although French opinion was at that time quite as much against what is still sometimes called le vice anglais as English opinion. Oscar Wilde left England forever, as it turned out, and went to the little village of Berneval, where a chalet was obtained for him. When he left prison, a sum of £800 was subscribed for him by various friends, the largest contributor being Miss Schuster. I was not asked to subscribe to this fund. The attitude of Ross, who was chiefly responsible for getting up the subscription, to which, however, I do not think he contributed, as he was at that time, and for a long time afterwards, almost entirely without money, was tacitly hostile to me, and his omission to ask me to subscribe was, no doubt, intended as a deliberate slight. If I had been asked to subscribe, I might or might not have been able to do so. I was living in Paris on a small allowance from my mother, and I seldom had a penny to spare. On the other hand, if I had made an urgent appeal to my brother Percy, I might probably have got £50 or so out of him for the purpose indicated. The official attitude of Oscar, instigated and kept alive by Ross, was, however, that he wished to have nothing whatever to do with me. I am amazed now when I think of the patience and meekness with which I bore this offensive and utterly unmerited treatment. If I had taken Wilde at his word, and neither written to him nor attempted to see him again, the whole course of my life would have been changed to my advantage. Nor would it ever have been in the power of either himself or his faithful friends to reproach me. Instead of doing this, however, I wrote to him at once, and said, in effect, "I am told that you now hate me, and do not wish to see me or have anything to do with me. But all the same, I write to tell you that I have not changed to you, in spite of all the efforts that have been made to put me against you, that I have remembered and kept my solemn promise to stick to you through thick and thin, and that I long to see you again." It is, I think, almost certain that this letter of mine, and a lot more that I wrote to Oscar about this time, were among the number which Ross appropriated and kept when Oscar was lying dead at the Hotel d'Alsace. If so, it is almost equally certain that Ross's heirs or executors have still got them. Once more, I ask that they should be given back to me. Oscar replied at once, in a somewhat priggish, if not canting, tone. He said that he did not hate me, and, on the contrary, still loved me very much, but that at present he thought it better that we should not meet. Although it was not a very nice letter, it certainly was a long way removed from the sort of thing I had been led to expect. Under the rather formal and lecturing surface of the letter, it was easy for me to see that Oscar was very far from having arrived at the state of mind so much desiderated by the faithful friends who were so anxious, for reasons best known to themselves, to take charge of his actions and feelings. To put it plainly, I guessed at once that he was longing to see me, but that other people were putting obstacles in his way. A number of the letters which Oscar wrote to me this time have been published, not for sale, by a Mr. William Andrews Clark, Jr., in America. They have been magnificently produced in facsimile, and are supplemented by notes which are ably and fairly written. The writer of the notes points out at once that one of the letters completely disposes of the Ross Harris version of the reunion of Oscar and myself. I will explain later in this book how I came to part with the letters, and how the promise made to me by the person who acquired them that they would not leave his possession during his or my lifetime was violated by his successors in business. At present, all I need say is that the letters have been published. I think it rather extraordinary that Mr. Andrews Clark did not have the courtesy to send me a copy of the book, which I saw and carefully went through when I was staying with Frank Harris in Nice in 1925. But possibly he did not realise that I would wish to have it. The publication of the letters bears out what I have already said, that the more of Oscar's letters to me and my letters to him are made public, the better it will be for my reputation and his own. The letters are entirely creditable both to their writer and their recipient. End of chapter 23.